Six, reel one.
Mr. Downing, reel one. Now, in 1943, you were concerned with the famous Arctic convoys. Can you tell me how that came about in your case, which ship you went out on, and what status you had, and so on?
Yes, at the end of 1942, I came home from the Mediterranean. I'd been serving on a trawler in the Mediterranean, and within a few weeks, I found myself detailed off to go up to North Russia. It was a pretty anxious time because at the time while I was waiting for my convoy to take me up to Russia, the famous convoy with Captain Sherbrooke on it was having a lot of trouble en route to Murmansk. Not only did they have enemy aircraft and all the other hazards of a Russian convoy, but they also had an encounter with the Hipper and Lutzow and a number of German destroyers. And of course, Captain Sherbrooke won the VC on that trip. And my convoy was the next one after that. 14 ships were in the convoy. We sailed on January the 17th, 1943, from Loch Hugh and called in at Iceland. And I had the most extraordinary passage because I was put on a Polish destroyer on passage up to the wireless station at Murmansk. I was put on a Polish destroyer called the Piorun. And it was, in addition to all the other hazards of being on a Russian convoy, I had the extraordinary business of being on a ship where nobody spoke English very much, if at all. All the crew were speaking in Polish, and the food was very strange to me. Mainly seemed to consist of sauerkraut, and I was completely out of context in the whole thing. And a most distressing trip up there, because there was hardly anyone I could talk to on the ship, and I hardly knew what was going on. I knew that the convoy was sighted because as you got off Bear Island, a large, I think it was a Blohm and Voss flying boat, would fly round the convoy just out of gunshot range. And this was homing, and this was the standard procedure, of course, homing U-boats onto the flying boat was homing U-boats onto the convoy. This was standard procedure, of course. And there were a large pack of U-boats ready to attack this convoy. But in fact, I think owing to the strength of the escorts there and the fact that the U-boat commanders had an extraordinary habit of chattering over the air to each other before they carried out an attack. It seems incredible now, looking back on it, that before they attacked, the Germans would all talk to each other on the radio. And of course, we had RDF, it later became radar, of course, we had RDF then, and we were able to get good bearings on the U-boats, and of course, we were able to concentrate attack in the direction which we knew they were. And this attack was driven off, and we had very little trouble from U-boats. We knew they were about, we had the knowledge they were about, because we were constantly picking up their signals. But in fact, no ships were lost from U-boat attack on that convoy. We were also attacked by torpedo-carrying bombers, HE-115s. They were driven off, and two of them were in fact shot down. But apart from that, that convoy arrived quite happily in the Kola Inlet without any loss of merchant ships, which was a bit unusual in those days to get one through absolutely safely.
Or escorts.
And no escorts were lost either. No, we lost no escorts and no merchant ships. The things I remember about that trip particularly were not only the enemy action, but also the constant crunching and banging of ice on the hull and the tremendous noise of the depth charges going off when the whole flotilla would fire off a pattern of depth charges together, the black nights and the knowledge that you couldn't survive in the icy water up there. There were estimates ranging from 30 seconds to a minute on your survival time if you went over the side. We wore a rope harness with a little red battery light on it that we could switch on. Apparently, if we fell in the water, we were supposed to plug this in so that we could be seen. And the rope harness was to assist anyone who was able to do so to pull us out quickly from the water. But the chances of survival were so little in that water that it added a very extra hazard to what was already a hazardous journey. I'd already been on Malta convoys, but you had the thought on a Malta convoy that if you went over the side, the water was warm. But on the Russia run, of course, there was no such thought in your mind at all. I had been sent up to Poliano Wireless Station as a telegraphist, and I was delighted to find friends there that had been with me on previous ships, which was wonderful for me, because the atmosphere there in that wireless station was very, very strange. It was in Navy House, guarded by Russian sentries, and only a small party of us, perhaps 30 at the most. And we had an admiral in charge, just of about 30 ratings, and a few other officers, of course, as well. It was an extraordinary place to be. Of course, at that time of the year when I went up there, total darkness for 24 hours. There was no light at all. Later on in the year, I stayed there for two winters, actually. I came back in February of the next year, so I had two winters up in the Arctic. And during what you could call the summertime, you get a sort of twilight up there, and then it gets better and better until suddenly the sun's not going down at all at night, and you're in daylight for 24 hours. Most extraordinary place. But when I arrived, of course, we were in the dark period, and we had to really come to terms with a very, very strange habitude up there altogether. There were nowhere to go, obviously, outside the wireless station. We were on skis, of course. We had to get around on skis. The stores came in on dog sledge. It's most extraordinary, really. You would get your beer supplies in. They'd been standing on the jetty for a while. They were in tins, like all beer was in those days, of course, and still is, I suppose. And you got hold of your tin of beer, and it said, chill before serving. And, in fact, you had to stand it on a stove before you could actually get it liquid enough to drink. The wireless station worked to Admiralty and also to convoys when they were coming and going. We kept in touch with the convoys as they came and went. I have one or two thoughts about Murmansk there. Of course, the in this dark period we had some fascinating views of the Aurora Borealis. It really was a free firework display most nights up there. Quite an incredible sight to see the northern lights off Murmansk there. In the summertime, of course, when it was perpetual light, the convoys were unable to come in, and so we were stuck, and any stores we hadn't got we had to do without. This of course meant all sorts of difficulties. We were allowed to visit the Russian Fleet Club once a week, and for this purpose, incoming convoys would leave us a film, and the Russians would let us use their projection room, and we were able to see some films up there. But of course, the light period meant that whatever film was left up there when the convoys stopped coming, we were stuck with. But we weren't eager to lose the facility of using the Russian Fleet Club, and so once a week we would put our number one suits on and go to the Russian Club and see the film we'd seen before. In fact, I saw the film called The Great Waltz 17 times, and I can still act pieces from it.
What were the Russians themselves like, the Russian seamen?
The Russian sailors were marvellous people. They were very much like any sailors anywhere. I have this theory that a sailor is a sailor is a sailor. The local people, of course, up there are very, very, I suppose you'd almost call them Laplanders, the people who live up in that part of the world.
You mean racially speaking?
Yes, they are really reindeer people. But at the naval base where we met the Russian sailors, extremely friendly towards us. Extremely friendly, and very impressed with the exploits of the Royal Navy, because they had great respect for the RN. Yep, we got on fine on a local basis with sailor to sailor.
Did you get any impression as to the way in which they went on as a navy as compared with the Royal Navy?
They were very... This was a submarine base we were close to there and seemed to be very, very efficiently run. We saw the submarines going out, we saw them coming back again. We weren't involved in any of their exercises. It seemed. I mean, they were smartly turned out and very efficient looking. At the Fleet Club, we were all Jack Tars together. All jolly Jacks together there, Russian and English. And this is one of the extraordinary things, that of this association with the Russian sailors, they taught us to sing Russian songs. And on one occasion, we, the British Concert Party, gave a concert to the Russians, and we sang them Russian songs. We hadn't a lot of idea what we were singing. We learned them phonetically. And it went down very, very well. We also sang Land of Hope and Glory, and that doesn't get done very often in Russia, I'm sure. But it went down very well. We had a concert party there. I was part of it. We were terribly lucky because we had on our staff one of the touring officers had been with the BBC as a producer, a chap called James Bold. And he was a real professional, and he turned out a concert party that could really have gone anywhere. We were pretty good. And we used to give concerts on visiting ships, for instance, as well as to the Russians and ourselves. We put on pantomimes. You know, it was one of the essential things for passing the time away, I suppose. I was also editor of the magazine. We used to hold Sunday morning services, and at that time, one of the chaps in the concert party had an accordion, a piano accordion. He was drafted home, and I was left the only man up there with any sort of instrument, and I had a mandolin banjo. And so, on Sunday mornings, with my mandolin banjo, I became the organist, and the admiral would read out the hymn number from the sheets, and I would play the tune on the mandolin. So it was quite an accomplishment to be an organist for northerly church services there. We spent a lot of time skiing up there. It was the only activity we could really get involved in. We all used to go out, including the admiral, skiing in the snow.
Were there any enemy attacks?
Yes, we had a lot of air raids coming over the from over the Finnish border. Of course, we were fairly close. Murmansk isn't all that far from Finland, and the Germans were attacking from that point. Of course, we were getting quite a lot of air raids. We had to evacuate the office because it was pretty hot at times there.
Did the air raids do much damage or cause casualties?
No, we didn't lose anyone. Broken glass cuts, but no one was seriously hurt from that at all. I had this lovely experience, though, of being sent down to Moscow with some confidential books. Not just me. There were three ratings, of which I was one, and a 2.5 ring officer, lieutenant commander. And this train journey to Moscow from Murmansk took something like 4 days. The commander had arranged that in addition to the confidential books, we took our own stores with us and a small Primus stove, and also buckets and scrubbers. And each morning after we got up and had breakfast, the three ratings would scrub the train compartment out, polish the brass and brightwork, while the commander would stand in the corridor, and then we'd report ready for rounds, and he would come and look round the compartment, make sure it was fit and fine. Then he would pipe up spirits, and we'd settle down for the day. By the time we got to Moscow, that carriage stood out from the rest on the train. It was a wood-burning train, extraordinary. I mean, something we don't think of in this country, but of course they had more wood than coal to spare. So it was a wood-burning train piled with logs in the tender. Of course.
Did the Russians see you performing these?
Oh yes, they thought we were most extraordinary people. Yes, 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 they did. They did indeed. Well, I had my banjo with me, and they used to join in the sing songs in the evening. It was quite fun. We had a lot of fun on that trip. One little memory that comes back to me: we stopped at a wayside halt once, and people came up and gave us caviar wrapped in newspaper. Masses of it. I mean, when you think of the cost of caviar. And one of the things we could make on the stove, which was in the corner of the compartment, there was a little wood-burning stove in the compartment, we could make toast. So on this extraordinary train trip, we were able to have caviar on toast, which is quite extraordinary, isn't it? Unbelievable. In Moscow, it was at a time when the Russians were practically hammering on the gates.
The Germans?
Sorry, I beg your pardon. The Germans. The Germans were hammering on the gates of Moscow. And things were very, very tight and very, very little in the shops at all. We went to the GUM stores, which are a very famous store in Moscow. It had very little to offer apart from classical gramophone records, which we bought, and one or two bits and pieces. But it was quite pathetic to see this enormous store, you know, which is, I don't know, it must be bigger than Selfridges or Harrods, and so little to sell. But the ballet was going on, as usual, at the Bolshoi, and I went to the Bolshoi. Extraordinary with the... I forget how we were getting our rubles there, but whatever we were doing to get rubles, I had plenty of them. And I was able to get a box at the Bolshoi. Not that I particularly wanted it, because I hadn't got... It was mainly because I hadn't got enough of the language to know what I was ordering. But I found myself with a box at the Bolshoi and saw Swan Lake. And the ballerina was Olga Leprashenskaya. And she was wonderful, I thought. Also in the audience were a party from the British Embassy. And I suppose that going to the ballet and seeing Swan Lake over and over again was one of their main spare time occupations. Because when it got to the bit in Swan Lake where the ballerina does 42 fouettes, they all counted out loud. 1, 2, 3. Most extraordinary. Until they got up to 42 when they applauded. I don't think that could go down well at Covent Garden. I don't think it went down too well at the Bolshoi, actually.
Do you know the month that you went there?
Yeah, well, it was just before I came back to... It would be about October, November.
43.
43, yes.
Were the people starving there, or were they getting...
Oh, they appeared not to be starving, but I think... I mean, there was no sign to me that they were starving, but I... because I didn't have all that contact with the local people. I was staying at the British Embassy, where things were all right, of course. The only thing I have to go on was that the shops were... absolutely empty.
Were there air raids there?
No air raids while I was there at all. No air raids on Moscow. But we knew from the news that the Germans weren't far away. Particularly the three ratings, the officer, I don't suppose, stood out very much. But we three ratings in our bell-bottom trousers were regarded with great curiosity, because you probably know the Russian uniform is fairly straight-down trousers, narrow trousers, and... large bottom, bell bottom trousers caused a great deal of interest.
Did people come up to you and speak to you?
Oh, yes. Yes, they did. Yes. Oh, yes. Very friendly towards us. Very friendly. In actual fact, in one of the cinemas in Moscow, in which we served, was showing, and it had been dubbed with Russian voices. And we went along to see that. It's quite extraordinary to see John Mills apparently speaking fluent Russian, and an old coward speaking fluent Russian.
What type of things did the Muscovites say to you?
They would say things like "Ochin хорошо," which roughly means "you are very good." You are very good. And they would pat us on the back and touch our shoulders. You see, we hadn't got enough language, really, to converse. We only had a little conversational stuff, which we picked up from the sentries up at Murmansk. I hadn't got enough to carry out a conversation. But the atmosphere, you could sense, was very friendly towards British sailors. They were extremely nice to us up there. And then the journey back... to Pollyanno, again on the wood-burning train. On this wood-burning train, of course, it passed very close to the Finnish border, and both on the way out down to Moscow and on the way back, we were told to lie on the floor while, I think, soldiers manned the sides of the train ready for any action if the train had been attacked. In fact, nothing happened either way, but we were told to lie down on the floor of the train. I got back to Pollyanno just in time for the sinking of the Scharnhorst. We were obviously the nearest wireless station to the Scharnhorst action. And what we were doing was we were taking the signals from the ships involved in the action and relaying them all to Admiralty. And it was Christmas Eve, my memory tells me. This was Christmas Eve, or the day before Christmas Eve. It was Christmas time, anyway. And we received this signal eventually from the Duke of York, Scharnhorst sunk, and we relayed that to the Admiralty. I think probably this was the way the Admiralty learned that the Scharnhorst had been sunk, because I can't believe that they were signalling direct to the Admiralty from the ships. They may have been, but certainly we relayed the signal, Scharnhorst sunk. After the action, the Duke of York came into the Kola Inlet. Duke of York battleship came into the Kola Inlet, and Admiral Fraser came aboard and came round the wireless station, and he chatted to the ratings, including myself. And I made a bit of a gaffe there. He asked me how things were, and for want of something better to say, I said, "It gets very wet when it thaws up here." And he said to me, "It gets very damp at sea as well, you know." Which I thought was a wonderful put-down. Well, then, soon after that, of course, the good news came that I'd done my service up there, which had gone on a bit too long anyway, and that I was going home. And I was told I'd go back to UK in January 1944. In fact, I loaded my gear and went aboard the Savage, a destroyer called the Savage, ready to come home on a convoy. Unfortunately, an incoming convoy had got itself mixed up with a pack of 15 U-boats near Bear Island, and all the escort ships in Kola Inlet were suddenly sent off to back up the convoy which was in trouble off Bear Island. And although I'd only got on board for the passage home, I found myself on my way to this big action off Bear Island. In fact, what the admiral in charge of the convoy did was, when our reinforcements arrived, he used us as an outer screen round his own destroyer force. So it was a pretty formidable destroyer array guarding this convoy.
What did you see of the action?
Heard more than saw the noise and the tremendous noise when all the escorts fired off a pattern of depth charges. A tremendous upheaval in the water, because in the small, relatively small area of a convoy, you had nearly 40, or perhaps that's an exaggeration, about 30 perhaps, destroyers, all firing a pattern of depth charges simultaneously. And the upheaval was absolutely tremendous. And there's no doubt about it, the U-boats were driven off. But unfortunately, the Hardy was sunk by a Nat torpedo, which we'd all heard about. The Nat torpedo, which hadn't previously been used on Arctic convoys, had been used on Atlantic convoys, homed itself on the noise of the propellers of a ship. And one of these got the Hardy.
Did you see the Hardy go down?
Didn't see her go down. No. Heard it. Heard about it. Great distress on board.
What was the date of this incident, please?
We are now in January. End of January 1944. End of January 1944. Perhaps about the 27th, 28th of January 1944. So no merchant ships were lost, and the Hardy went down. It's the second Hardy which was lost in the war. This was a new destroyer which had been named after a Hardy which had been sunk on Norway, in Norway, I think it was at Narvik, perhaps. So, having got myself on a destroyer to come home, I then found myself in this action, and then going back again to the Kola Inlet, where I changed ships. And I think I was on one of the V&Ws. I came home eventually on the Vigilant. That's the name I've got in my head. Anyway, I did that little run out on the Savage, and then I changed ships again when we got back to Kola. And this time I came home on the Vigilant. Well, from this action which had taken place off Bear Island, the next outgoing convoy had a magnificent escort, because it had got the incoming escort and also the outgoing escort. And the convoy sailed in early February, and as I remember it, there was almost one destroyer for every merchant ship. And we knew there were U-boats about. I think it was reported there were 15 in the area, and we fired off a lot of patterns. I remember, because I did some time in the wireless cabin, that the code word was grab, 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 and this signal to the destroyer flotilla meant fire pattern of depth charges. And when we said grab, 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 away they went, and I can't visualize how many depth charges would go off with about 30 destroyers firing a pattern all at once. But again, we lost no ships at all on the way home on that one. So I was involved in two big convoys with no loss, and the Bear Island run, which I was involved in, we lost, unfortunately, the Hardy. And that was my Russian experience. Long time after I got home, the chap who'd been up in Russia with me decided he would write a story about life in North Russia, and he sent it to the publishers, who said that they didn't like the story as it was, but they thought it had possibilities, and that he should get hold of Alex Downing, who he mentioned in the story, and get some more information. He started to look for me, and he put my name out on radio programs, which I didn't hear. He put my name in magazines and newspapers, and I didn't see it at all. And it took him best part of a year to find me. I'd moved from my previous address. He wrote to every house in the road, but nobody knew me or knew where I was. But out of his writing and the advertisements, he managed to get names of, at first, 40 or 50 people who'd been up in Russia. And when eventually he did find me, he formed the North Russia Club.
Who was this?
Christopher Tai. Now, from this North Russia Club, I think for the first time there came a list of people who'd served on Russian convoys. And the Russians, who'd apparently wanted to pay a tribute to people who'd been on Russian convoys for years, but the Admiralty, with the system of keeping records of the Admiralty, there was no way apart from going through everybody.